So Rich, John, it is such a treat to have you guys here at Bridgewater on our campus to talk about some of the issues we've been talking about with our clients. You know, one of the reasons that I wanted to have both of you in is, first of all, you advise on trillions of dollars worth of assets across the world, multiple types of entities from sovereign wealth funds to family offices and everything in between. And therefore, you see what's happening in global portfolios. You see where the vulnerabilities are, and hopefully can have big impact in terms of how to steer portfolios in the right direction, not for the past, but for the future. So with that said, I want to share with you some of the things that we've been pretty vocal on, which is that today when we look at portfolios, we both understand why big institutional pools of capital are positioned the way they are, which is very, very concentrated in equity risk, very concentrated in U.S. equity risk and the U.S. dollar, and much less exposure to diversifying return streams, and also relatively, materially more illiquid exposure than what we saw prior to, let's say, 2010 or what have you. And by and large, all that's worked out over the last 15 years. So we find ourselves in a very interesting position. And I haven't even gotten to the pricing of the main asset that people have, which is U.S. equities. So that's how we're seeing it. And what we're saying to clients is we really believe there's a material need for you to pay attention to these issues right now and be intentional about whether you want to continue with that kind of exposure or whether now it's time to diversify. That is what Bridgewater's been saying. I want to turn to both of you and have you synthesize how you're viewing the global picture and what you think is most important. And I'll start with you, John.
Sure. Thanks, Jim. I think to start, let's recognize that part of the reason we're in the situation we are today is because it has worked for the last 10 to 15 years. And what that means is it can be hard for asset owners to take a look back and say, let's do something different. But from our perspective, there are more risks in the world today, or differentiated risks than perhaps that we've seen. Over the last 15 years, you had zero interest rates, you had very low inflation. You didn't necessarily see a world where that spiked. Today, we have two sides of that risk. You could see increased inflation, stickier inflation, or you could see recession. And so from that standpoint alone, taking a step back, looking at the portfolio, making sure that you're comfortable with where you sit going forward, and that you're comfortable with the risks that you hold, in particular, the concentration risk in U.S. assets, is key for asset owners from here.
And just before I turn to Rich, is this business as usual, or is this more like, no, I want this is front of mind as you're sitting there with your client relationships about what you think they ought to be focused on?
This is certainly front of mind, particularly given, you know, we just had a recent bout of quite a bit of volatility, which opened eyes. And so I think there is an impetus now to take that step back and really look going forward. Are we going to be in a different environment, and are we comfortable with the way that our portfolios sit from here?
So Rich, let me turn to you. John talked about the fact that, yes, he sees vulnerabilities and it's front of mind. Let me just ask you, do you see those same vulnerabilities, and is it front of mind or business as usual?
I see those vulnerabilities in spades, and it's front of mind. And I'll divide asset owners into two camps. U.S. home country investors, U.S. dollar denominated investors, tend to be massively overweight the U.S. against global market capitalization because that's worked well. And if they moved away from that, they underperformed their peer group. And so the governance dynamics were such that they moved back to being overweight. Non-U.S. investors have been beat up if they were underweight the U.S. And so I try to take a blank sheet of paper approach when I'm meeting with an asset owner. But I kind of expect to see not just the U.S. stock market, but the U.S. dollar overweight and unhedged, the U.S. economy, the U.S. stock market, yes, but also in their private market allocations, particularly private equity, real estate, private credit, to see a massive overweight to the U.S. compared to its GDP weight or even its market cap weight in public markets, because that's where the strong IRRs have been. Investors looking for private market allocations have come to the U.S. because that's where the success has been. And so they're even more overweight there than they are in the public markets.
Now, Bridgewater, we've been articulating two big things. One is that we're operating in a new paradigm. We're calling it modern mercantilism. which is distinctly different from, let's say, the global free market capitalism type of system that we've been in. There's many points of difference, right? There's, you know, trade is like a zero-sum game now, as opposed to a winner, you know, win-win game. National strength is important. Controlling supply lines is important because geopolitical conflict is much more acute today. So there's a difference in the paradigms, which are not as supportive of assets as previously, or most assets. That's number one. Number two is the pricing is completely different. You know, if you go back to 2010, U.S. equities on a valuation basis by historical standards were relatively cheap because we just had the sell-off from the global financial crisis, the dollar was attractive, and you had all this supportive monetary and fiscal policy, which was starting to add up, you know, to an attractive tailwind. You also had, you know, viable tech companies. We were still leaders in tech and so on. So all these things were going on. Geopolitical conflict was not nearly as acute as it is today. So those were the tailwinds. And yet today, many of those things are flipped. So U.S. valuations on an absolute basis are at the higher end of their historical valuations. And on a relative basis to other markets, Japan or Europe is very, very stretched relative to normal. So that's another reason why the comment, you know, the change in paradigm and the change in pricing has led us to being quite vocal. I want to see if you both see it the same way or differently, and feel free to totally disagree and tell us we're completely wrong, which is the change in paradigm and the change in pricing. Let me start with you, Rich.
I think it's even worse than you characterize, because it's not just the public markets price for perfection and trading at high valuations. In the private markets, private credit spreads have come in. Instruments that used to get 5% yield premium against comparable investment grade public, you're getting 3 or 2.5. If it was 3, it's now 1. And that's causing smart CIOs to think, I don't know what's going to trigger the next crisis, but we're a day closer to it than we were yesterday, and it's going to happen at some point. So a lot of examination of portfolios to, are we really well diversified, and is our governance ready for the next crisis? Because the global economic flywheel has been moving pretty well. Other than China, we've had full employment with inflation coming under control. We've even powered through the uncertainty shock, the wait and see shock of the Liberation Day announcements and all the trade and tariff discussions over the last few months. We've powered through that. And as we started the conversation today, we're up 5.5% as a dollar denominated investor in U.S. equities year to date. That's an amazing accomplishment. Lots of strength there, lots of optimism. But when I talk with smart CIOs, they think, too much optimism, and we need to be ready.
Mm-hmm. And that's the paradigm. Do you see a paradigm change?
Well, the big paradigm change that's causing panic amongst CIOs is that the U.S. dollar and U.S. treasuries have not behaved as safe haven assets year to date. We got, John mentioned earlier, the market volatility, the VIX spiked to 50, our one-month gauge of forward-looking volatility that you can bet on. So smart people were saying, we think on average the market's going to be 50% volatile now as opposed to 15 pre these announcements. Okay, we didn't see that level of market volatility previously. You have to go back to March 2020, depths of COVID, when the real world looked like it might actually be coming to an end, or October 2008, when it looked like both the financial world and the real world were coming to an end. We had the U.S. auto sector bankrupt. We had entire states in fiscal deficit, you know, mass unemployment. And didn't know that we were going to come back. So really high market volatility. And historically, when we had that kind of shock, the dollar did well and treasuries did well, and suddenly they didn't. And that just causes all the asset allocation risk budgeting math that people have been relying on, that gets thrown out the window, and we need a new paradigm.
So from our perspective, yes, it is somewhat of a new paradigm, but the U.S. still, while valuations are quite high relative to elsewhere, still do have a lot of technological innovation that's happening here that is strong. I think when we think about the concentration in markets and using equities as the example, given the growth that you've seen in the U.S. market over the last 15 years, I think it's just making sure we take a step back and that we're getting the right diversification. If we are in a world where you do see individual countries or blocks at least kind of moving within and trying to recreate supply lines onshore as opposed to offshore, having more exposure to different parts of the world and different economies or different blocks will be helpful. You also have a change in a shift from Europe. If you think about the way that for Germany, for example, has adjusted their budget to spend more, to move away from austerity. And so while those assets are are quite cheap on a valuation basis. You have some tailwinds behind as well for why those should be do well. But at the same time, a lot of that innovation is still coming from U.S. domiciled countries. So it's not a sell the U.S. so much as it is make sure we have the right diversification and you're getting that exposure at a level that's going to support your portfolio.
So let me dig a little bit deeper into this. And John, I'm going to start with you. When I look at not only the state of portfolios, but the pricing of those portfolios, what I see is U.S. equity valuations around all-time highs. So on an absolute level, you know, the threshold for repeating the same kind of performance that we had before over the last 15 years is probability of that is quite low, just statistically. And then I see a different paradigm that we talked about, right? Mm-hmm. But in that, I also see foreign valuations, so, you know, around the world, much more competitive than what I see in the U.S. So let me just talk about what that implies. Is now the time to move exposures from the U.S. to foreign markets, whether that be Japan or in Europe or where, what have you, just more diversified, simply because the pricing is so extreme between U.S. valuations and foreign valuations?
It's a great question. I don't think that it's necessarily that because of the extremities of those valuation differentials, we should automatically be overweighting Europe relative to a market cap benchmark or overweighting Japan. That being said, we do think there's opportunities, but there's also reasons why we're in the position we are today. You've seen, particularly relative to Europe, you've seen a lot more of the technological innovation coming from the U.S., and that still is absent within the European markets. And so there is some reason for why valuations are so differentiated. But we have seen with the removal of some of the austerity starting to come through in Europe that perhaps there is opportunity to see a bit more growth coming out of those markets and a bit more attractiveness, not purely based on valuations. Take Germany, for example, with the spending that they plan to do in the budget on both infrastructure as well as defense. But seeing that shift in mindset from one of pure austerity to one somewhat more pro-growth, I think will be helpful for markets. And so we do think that there's some attractive opportunities there. Similarly in Japan, we do think that there's opportunity. There continues to be opportunity in the Japanese market. And so looking at perhaps shifting some of that U.S., I'll call it quote-unquote overweight, to other markets, I think it is an appropriate step to be considering.
Rich?
I think it is. It's never too early or the wrong time to diversify. And asset owners, particularly when there are lay trustees involved, so non-investment experts, they often focus on the top level. So the U.S. has stronger GDP growth than the rest of the G7, better demographics than most of the rest of the G7, a lot of the thesis of U.S. exceptionalism is still alive, and we have the Magnificent Seven all headquartered here. That's a lot of good things. But then on a valuation standpoint, if the price-to-earnings ratio on U.S. stocks is twice what it is in Europe and Japan, which is about where it's been, that means that those U.S. companies have to deliver twice the earnings growth to justify the valuation differential. And so looking at valuations can help asset owners adjust quickly for, okay, so we understand Europe's overregulated and has worse demographics. We understand Japan and China are competing for who has the worst demographics on the planet. And yet, if we're getting the same earnings yield at half the cost, maybe we should have some of our portfolio there. So it's an issue of balance. And then if the growth comes through, again, it depends on the client's investment objectives. There's a big difference between a client who's peer group median benchmarked and so can't be very different from their competitors, and an asset owner that really wants to pursue an economic objective, where if they're more diversified than other funds, as long as they're hitting their investment objective, it doesn't matter if others have done better. But really understanding, are you peer group median benchmarked and you're going to get compared after the fact to the group? Or are you really able to pursue your economic objective? I think that's an important prerequisite to then either letting the math drive the diversification or being very careful about making big bets against what your competitors are doing.
So I read both of you as saying, from a pure investment perspective, it, you know, given the starting concentration of these portfolios in U.S. equities, that from a pure investment perspective, it would pay to diversify. Just because even if you were wrong, right, you already have such a concentrated bet in U.S. equities. However, there are real governance issues to work through, and those governance issues can basically, you know, if you're going to take that benchmark risk, then you need to be able to have your stakeholders bought in. Is that basically what I hear from you?
Yeah, that's a fair representation.
Yeah, and bought into where after the fact, and you can try to help them pre-experience this, if they look at their performance report and they're getting cash plus 5 or inflation plus 4, they're happy, even if their competitors are getting 16 nominal in that particular year or 3-year period.
Right.
So, you know, are they going to be happy in that or not? If they're not, if their revealed risk tolerance is different, if their revealed objective is different after the fact, the portfolio can get whipsawed, which is not a good way to invest.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, things like pre-mortems can help with that with multiple stakeholders, particularly when you're getting into stakeholders.
Explain pre-mortems.
So thinking about what could go wrong, how could this go against you? So to Rich's example of a stakeholder who you think that perhaps you're more economic sensitive from a benchmark standpoint, but after the fact you've underperformed the peer group and that's where issues arise. Have a look at that ahead of time. Show what those numbers could look like and have the discussion of where did this go wrong? Why did it go wrong? And are we comfortable with it?
On this question of geographic diversification, I think we've even written some pieces. We talked about Asia. We've talked about even in AI, how you could get diversification outside the US. And it's mostly on the diversification piece. And my question to you is, taking diversification aside, do you see any good return possibilities? You mentioned Europe, you know, and the fiscal situation in Europe starting to present a potential tailwind there. And in Japan, we've seen a little bit of a tailwind as well. But are there any particular markets where you say, not only is it good to diversify, I actually think this is going to be a really good story and you're advising clients as such? Let me start with you, Rich.
Short answer is yes. And I'll take it even further. You mentioned kind of developed market regions, Western Europe, Japan. But we're bullish about the emerging and frontier market economies on a long-term basis. That doesn't necessarily mean overweighting emerging and frontier market domiciled stocks. The Magnificent Seven produce and sell globally. Those are global multinationals, not just U.S. companies. So when you invest in publicly traded stocks, you need to look at what's the underlying source of revenue and NOI. But 70 to 80% of the world's population is in the emerging frontier markets. If you look back the last 10 years at global GDP growth, about 60 to 70% of global GDP growth is happening in those markets. And many of them are coming from low income to middle income, which is a pretty well-trodden place to go. They're benefiting hugely from getting labor pulled into the global workforce without having to physically emigrate by the evolution of digital and AI technologies, particularly the ability to translate to and from English in any local language for labor that didn't have English as a second language and otherwise wouldn't be able to participate in the global economy. So there's a lot of bullishness there. And that's part of what's driving the interest in infrastructure as an asset class. We recently did our annual large asset owner barometer survey. And the two asset classes where asset owners above $2 billion told us they're going to put the most new money are infrastructure and private credit. And when we dig below the headline, well, what are you looking for there? With infrastructure, it's exposure to the local economy and local GDP growth because infrastructure investments tend to be inherently local. And then for private credit, it's through asset-based finance, through regulatory arbitrage, other areas where it's not correlated to the broad economy. It's not even correlated to broader credit. And so you're getting some real diversification that you can't get in the public markets. Now, with those two asset classes, you take on more liquidity risk, and liquidity hasn't been there in private equity or real estate or infrastructure or private credit in the way that a lot of asset owners expected. So you're kind of doubling down on an area where there's already been a disappointment in terms of the amount of real liquidity money coming back. But the diversification potential, that's what's driving some of that, including getting beyond the developed markets into emerging frontier.
Yeah, I think what I'd agree with everything that Rich just said. I think the other thing I'd add on is what you're also moving beyond is corporate profits and what's driving the cash flows and the return generation. And I think from a not just a diversification standpoint, but also a return generation standpoint, moving beyond just making money off of corporate profits, whether that's through corporate debt or through equities, I think is a key to developing those long-term diversifying return streams that actually are return streams. I think the flip side from a return generation standpoint is also the protection side. And we've been in an environment where treasuries have been a key form of downside hedging for a lot of portfolios for some time. And I think we're entering a period where diversifying that is perhaps something we've seen a lot more interest in and have had a lot more discussions and movement on, even moving, not even getting to the point of moving beyond interest rates as a downside hedge, but even just where your interest rates are coming from, moving that to more than just the U.S., but to other sovereigns as well.
If I could amplify on John's point, when I meet with CIOs of really large investors, 100 billion plus investors, and ask them what are they most worried about or most shocked by, the concept of regime change comes up, and what they seem to be most worried about and kind of emotionally almost disturbed about is the U.S. Treasuries and U.S. dollar have not behaved as safe haven assets year to date. And so that doesn't just cause their portfolio to perform differently than expected. It blows the whole math of their diversification model, of their asset allocation model, out of the water. It's been in the data that when the world hits a crisis, U.S. treasuries do well, the U.S. dollar does well, and suddenly they don't. And so what do you do with your portfolio when one of the bedrocks of what you were doing? Another example of regime change is when stagflation in the U.S. is the issue, and to the extent we have relatively bullish versus bearish projections around tariff policy, that's a potential stagflationary shock. So that's been driving things. Well, then stock-bond correlations spike, and they've been running at about 80% year-to-date. So again, that breaks down diversification of your portfolio. Now, that's relatively more understood that in a stagflationary environment, that's going to happen. So it's not as shocking to people. It doesn't produce the same emotional reaction, but it does produce a sense of, okay, we're in a different regime, but actually we're in one past that we've never actually modeled or played with because the safe haven assets, U.S. dollar, U.S. treasuries, are suddenly not behaving as safe haven assets.
Let's talk about fixed income in general, okay? And, you know, if you go over the last 15 years, so post-global financial crisis to where we are today, by our measurements, by and large, approximately, allocations in global portfolios, institutional portfolios have been halved in fixed income. Some of that makes sense, right? Because you have zero interest rates for quite a long time over those 15 years. So what we've seen is more credit exposure in those fixed income indices, less overall exposure in portfolios, and then questions around even with those exposures, am I getting the diversification either because of the credit risk or because of other risks, these sovereign risks? So let me start generally first. How are you thinking about fixed income in general? Let me go to you, Rich, first. As a diversifier to equities. So if you were going to bring down your overall equities or bring down the U.S. component of the equities, is fixed income a good place to put it? And if so, how would you do it?
So it depends on the client. Where a client has enough money to achieve their real economic objectives, locking down in the right portfolio of high quality fixed income, real and nominal bonds to meet that can be attractive if they don't need the additional growth of doing everything else. But then there's a lot of drivers beyond that. And very few clients of any type have enough money that they don't want to go for some growth. So, but as an anchor to Windward or a hedge or, you know, kind of as an economic concept of, well, how much money would we need to achieve our objective forever? And if we had that, how would we invest it? You get that point on the frontier and then you work from there. But there's a lot been going on in the fixed income market. So low real and nominal yields, pre-COVID, half the investment grade bonds on the planet were trading at negative real yields. Basically a real challenge with getting economic return. Suddenly we have an economic return to bonds. So bonds are back in the sense of offering a positive real and nominal expected return, but after a long period when they didn't, and so allocations got cut because if you thought interest rates were going up, you definitely didn't want to hold them. If you thought interest rates were going to stay low, you didn't want to hold them in competition with other assets. Hedge funds are back because hedge funds provide diversification potential, have provided diversification potential. They may not be perfectly liquid, but they're much more liquid than many of the other diversifiers. And they're working off a cash yield that's now 4.25% plus what you get as opposed to 0% plus what you get. So hedge funds are back as part of the anchor to Windward. And then private credit brings the liquidity, but has a yield. The debt tranches of infrastructure and real estate investment have a longer term yield that you can lock in with some underlying inflation hedging characteristics, not necessarily CPI inflation, but some sense of real inflation. So that anchor to Windward part of the portfolio has become more diverse. The last thing I'll flag is the U.S. isn't the only country having trouble with fiscal deficits. Japan's got a worse debt-to-GDP ratio. Japan's Social Security and national health care are just as bad as the U.S., but because Japan has national health care, it's a bigger national issue. And Japan has worse demographics and a real problem with immigration because of the Japanese language as an entry barrier for foreign labor to be productive. So the two of the world's largest economies, the two largest in the G7, are looking unsustainable in terms of their ability to repay their debt. And periodically, we see very senior influential figures from the investment industries saying, maybe not in the next 3 months, but at some point this has to break. And so that sustainability, will the debt get repaid, or the declining credit quality of the major G7 issuers, that's also giving investors kind of pause. Is this really a risk-free asset? And if it's not, well, then maybe holding some of this other stuff makes more sense because we're getting some diversification there. And so, again, I think that drives a more diversified bond portfolio or anchor to windward and reduces the exposure to government securities.
So let me just synthesize. What you're saying is bonds could be a piece, but maybe not the piece that they were, because there are other alternatives that may not have some of the problems that bonds have.
Yeah. So the sort of bedrock of, well, U.S. Treasury is a risk-free asset. No, they're not. Suddenly they're not. They're not behaving that way. And there's real concern about the sustainability of the U.S. ability to pay this off. Mm-hmm. And then the dollar's not behaving as risk-free. It's lost 11% year-to-date. So if you're a foreign investor holding U.S. Treasuries, you're negative year-to-date. Even if you're holding the U.S. stock market, you're negative year-to-date because of what's happened with the currency. So suddenly there's risk in those assets. Even if you're a U.S. dollar-denominated investor, do you want to hold other things and at least get paid for the risk you're taking, a percent, 3% above Treasuries, recognizing Treasuries aren't risk-free?
Yeah. So, John, this issue about bonds is an interesting one because, you know, one of the things we've been saying is bonds are not risk-free. That's, we've sort of never thought they've been risk-free. But right now, given that inflation is a question, and that's been something that really, other than the, you know, year and a half coming out of COVID, other than that, inflation is really, if anything, inflation was too low at certain points. So, but now we are seeing, you know, not terrible pressures, but definitely, you know, pressures that are keeping the Fed slower than they otherwise would be at cutting rates, and other central banks are wary as well. So inflation is one. There's the U.S. dollar and the flows that were coming in from the foreign markets that may not be coming at the same pace, and that's a dollar weakener. And so our view has been, if you're going to play bonds, you've got to do it internationally, diversified, take advantage of other markets as well where yields are higher, be conscious of currency issues, and hire a good manager to do that. Rich is saying, you know, yep, but also other things like hedge funds and so on. What say you?
So I think it gets back to what Rich started with, is, which is, what is your objective if you're selling equities to buy other things? So if you're able to sell equities, take a slightly lower return expectation because you can still achieve your objectives, then bonds are a part of that that portfolio, but they're not everything. So we would agree with Rich in that. And I think it gets back to what you were just describing, which is risks right now are perhaps a bit more two-sided on interest rates than they have been for some time, other than that blip post-COVID, in that we may see more inflation. We may see either stickier than it's been, or another increase in inflation. But equally, we may see a recession, and we may see that go the other way, or stagflation being an issue, as Rich brought up. And so that means that you do need a more diversified bucket of things that can perform well in multiple scenarios. One of the pieces of that is looking at fixed income beyond just the U.S. Treasury as your kind of safe stone. But whether that's other jurisdictions, whether that's looking at more inflation-protected securities as well, with real rates no longer being zero or negative as they were several years ago, that can be an opportunity. But beyond that, we would agree that things like infrastructure, where there is a pass-through of inflation, perhaps it's not necessarily direct, but there is a pass-through of inflation. Things like gold become another opportunity that we've been discussing with clients, and that's something that we really hadn't in the past, because you could really rely on treasuries and the dollar as your safe havens, and we just think that you need more than that today.
So go ahead, Rich.
Well, I want to call out how different the environment is for the Fed as a central bank in the U.S. versus the central banks in the world ex-U.S. So the fact of U.S. tariffs is a stagflationary shock in the U.S. It's disinflationary in the rest of the world. It makes it tougher for the Fed to navigate the balancing act between full employment and inflation. In the rest of the world, it just gives central banks the ability to ease policy if they need to. Oil prices are down 11.5% year to date in dollars. The dollar's down 11.5%. So for the U.S., oil prices lower. That's the opposite of a stagflation shock. In the rest of the world, it's about twice the magnitude of a non-stagflation or the opposite of a stagflation shock. So again, room to ease policy, but also pro-growth. And then the U.S. dollar being down imports inflation in the U.S. And for the rest of the world is disinflationary because U.S. manufactured goods and services are suddenly 11.5% cheaper. So basically, reserve banks around the world could ease policy if they thought they needed to make the economy perform stronger, whereas the Fed has to navigate this balancing act. That's a real economic fundamental advantage to those non-U.S. economies, which, as we talked about earlier, were trading at half the price-to-earnings ratio to begin with. So another tailwind for diversification.
I want to explore this issue on inflation-linked bonds because, John, as you talked about, you know, when you looked at the past period, when we had 9%, we sort of had a peak of 9% in the U.S. 2021 through 2022, and inflation-linked bonds did a very bad job in hedging that inflation. And when you look at the whys for that, it became clear that, you know, it does really matter if you're coming off a position of zero real interest rates. Today, we're not coming off a position of zero real interest rates. We're, you know, depending on where you look on the curve, anywhere from 200 to 300 basis points of real interest rates. That's pretty attractive. I mean, I'm sure it could get more attractive even, but that's pretty attractive if you get that real yield plus, you know, the inflation accruals. So how are you looking at both inflation-linked bonds here in the United States as well as foreign inflation-linked bonds as one of the answers of sort of effective diversification?
So I think one of the keys is, and we learned this a few years ago when we did see that 9% spike in inflation, is there is no perfect hedge to inflation. And every inflationary environment is different than the next. And so having a basket of things that can help in those types of environments or can do well in a variety of them is the way that we're thinking about managing that risk. And so one of those is inflation-linked bonds, primarily talking about that in the U.S. today, but certainly part of the discussion is beyond the U.S. and into other jurisdictions. But I raised gold a moment ago. That is another asset that does well in many inflationary environments, not all. And then things like infrastructure and other inflation-linked cash flow generative assets. So real estate hasn't done well of late, but can be somewhat inflation-linked, not quite as much as infrastructure is. But looking for those sorts of opportunities where there is an inflation proportion of the cash flow generation within that asset, we think can help to broaden the level of environments with which the portfolio will be more stable.
Could I amplify on John's response in two ways? So one thing the last 10 years have taught us is, or urged us to pay attention to, is how limited the range of client objectives are that are really hedged by inflation-linked bonds, because so few clients have CPI inflation. Now, there are pension plans that have liabilities indexed to inflation. In that context, our Canadian clients wish the Canadian government were going to continue to issue inflation-linked bonds because they have real liabilities that they can no longer hedge. There's no longer an instrument available for them to hedge that. So where we have that, we have an elegant hedging solution if the client's well enough funded to use that. But for an endowment worried about all the costs of running a university, for a not-for-profit healthcare institution worried about the cost of running a hospital, for a family worried about their consumption basket, CPI is not a perfect hedge. And so you quickly get back to John's point to a much more interesting range of assets that will perform well, or at least perform stably in a higher than expected inflation environment, but aren't CPI linked. And so they're giving you a better expected return. They're giving you more diversification in your overall portfolio. They're not hedging CPI precisely, but for those types of investors, a precise hedge wouldn't have been what they needed anyway. They've got some different measures of inflation. They're going to need that expected return. I still think inflation-linked bonds can play a useful role in a portfolio like gold as an asset that behaves differently than other assets when inflation expectations pick up. So in a broad risk budgeting portfolio construction standpoint, as a diversifying asset with certain characteristics that are mathematically reliable, it can be attractive, but it's not to hedge the client's objective, because except for those DB pension plans or other truly CPI indexed liability investors, that's not actually the right economic objective anyway. So you're paying for a level of precision that you don't want, and you're giving up expected return to get it.
I want to turn to gold for a second because it certainly had quite a run. And the it sort of used to be the fact that when the dollar was solidly the world's reserve currency, that when dollar interest rates went up, that was a negative impact on gold prices because gold doesn't yield anything. And that all seemed to break. Like even during the period when, you know, nominal interest rates in the U.S. went up 500 basis points, basically, gold prices at least didn't fall and then have risen subsequently substantially. So I'm wondering, you know, you mentioned gold, John, and Rich, I haven't asked you yet about gold, but let's talk about gold as part of an inflation scenario or maybe part of a debasement, a currency debasement, hedge. How do you think about gold? What is the optimal allocation of gold for most institutional investors?
I think my starting point would be that, you know, it's the comment you just made about gold not being an asset with any yield. It's a difficult one that I've always struggled with putting it in a portfolio. But I think one thing that you can't necessarily refute is that it is an asset that does well in when fear is very much in the market. And so from that standpoint, it's an asset that will act differently than much of the portfolio, particularly when you're in an environment like today where uncertainty can go in multiple directions or a drawdown could be caused by multiple parts of the market. And so having something that should do relatively well if we have an inflationary shock or you see fear come through, or if you continue to see trade wars causing fear in the market, things like that is an interesting discussion. We've been debating quite a bit in our shop around what is the right allocation to gold. Is it something that you hold at all times? Should it be more dynamic? I struggle with how you would price it to be dynamic and how you're going to create a valuation case for gold. And so our debate has come more around how does that fit into an overarching basket of defensive assets within the portfolio, something that within that bucket is going to act differently and provide that ballast when markets are drawing down.
You know, Rich, on this gold question, there's a lot of debate, right? Let's take the U.S. fiscal position right now. You know, there was a huge transfer after the global financial crisis over the subsequent years of private sector debt onto the public sector balance sheet. If I had to sort of synthesize it, that's basically what's happened. And now public sector debt is, you know, well above what has typically been sustainable levels. And with interest rates higher and stubborn, that creates a real potential problem because interest servicing can overwhelm, especially with entitlement programs, can overwhelm sort of the discretionary parts of the budget. And so this brings the thought, like, you know, if the U.S. government were in a position where they couldn't pay back the real value of their obligations, you know, one way to do that is to print money, and that's the debasement thing. And as you mentioned, I think it was you, Rich, that said, they're not the only government in that kind of situation. Is that, in your view, you know, that or maybe the geopolitical angle of non-aligned, you know, states with the U.S., why gold has been rising and why you would have it in a portfolio?
I think there's three reasons why gold has been rising. And one of them head on is concern about the U.S. dollar as a global reserve currency. So central banks have been increasing their net purchase of gold. Some investors trying to hedge the risk of monetization of the U.S. debt or the U.S. losing its role as reserve currency. There's a family of concerns around the sustainability of the U.S. fiscal situation that's leading some investors to hold gold as a long-term hedge. Other investors are holding it as a short-term hedge because it's easier to explain to their stakeholders, we've got gold as an anchor to windward for a crisis, as opposed to doing something really interesting with volatility swaps or put protection or getting into options math. And also, will the derivative markets hold up and behave the way that they have historically in a real crisis? I think that's one lesson the GFC is you can model swaptions all day long, but in a real crisis, are they even going to be available on the terms that you expect, much less behave the way that they do? Whereas gold in a vault somewhere, you have a reasonable basis to believe, okay, the price is going to spike in a crisis or at least perform well against other assets. So there's a family of things causing gold to go up, but it all comes down to either sustainability of the U.S. or other governments' ability not just to repay their debt, but to do it without monetizing the debt by letting inflation run away. And then and then the lack of a substitute for the U.S. dollar. Like, where are you going to run? The BRICS currencies aren't even freely convertible, so you can't go there. The yen, the euro, sterling, it's, you know, the U.S. is still the least dirty T-shirt in my laundry basket, and I've got to wear something to class. So, you know, it's but gold is there. Gold is clean. It's well understood by stakeholders. It you know, it's performed pretty reliably in that hedging function. So again, a family of things driving interest in gold.
We talked about we just mentioned kind of the dollar and gold being an attractiveness, and where else would you go? But one of the interesting things is over the last 15 years or so, post global financial crisis, up to where we are today, by and large, foreign investors have done great in the U.S. equity market and in an unhedged way. So they've gotten a lift that's very unique in history, where not only have the equity returns been great, but they've also gotten the extra currency returns as well. And I think, you know, you were talking about before, like, the reasons for why portfolios are where they are. I mean, that extrapolation in the future means that there's not a lot of hedging of currency exposure that we see in U.S. equity allocations or other U.S., you know, dollar-denominated allocations. And that may be changing, right? And that may be changing. So my question to you is, do you think it's changing? Is the role of the U.S. dollar in the international system changing? And as a result of that, let's say, first starting with investors outside of the United States, are you advising them to hedge their currency exposures? Let me go first to you, John.
Yep. So from our perspective, we do think it's changing. We do see a movement to hedging a bit more of the exposure, not necessarily all of it, but hedging more than has done in the past. I think there's a couple of reasons for that. I think one is what we've discussed already, in that the dollar may not be a flight to quality asset anymore, and it certainly hasn't been thus far year to date. And so from that standpoint, you know, there was the dual benefit of U.S. equities going up and being unhedged to the dollar, which was great. But now, if we don't think that dollar exposure is going to be a flight to quality to help stabilize even the equity returns a little bit, then perhaps we take some of that off. I think the other side is just a recognition of, broadly speaking, a lot of non-U.S. investors are, as we've been discussing thus far today, just have so much exposure to the U.S. dollar and to U.S. assets, broadly speaking, and taking some of that lack of currency hedge off the table does reduce that a little bit. And so bringing that back as we've seen this evolution in the market has been things that we've been discussing, and we've seen some movement from our non-U.S. clients.
How do you think about that?
So depending on the home currency for non-dollar denominated investors, in our modeling, until they get to around 30 to 50% foreign currency exposure between their stock, bonds, and alternatives, having a static strategic hedge doesn't pay. And there's kind of a deep part of the U where it doesn't matter that much, and then suddenly it starts to matter. Even for asset owners that have run that math, because as you mentioned, the U.S. dollar's done so well recently, they've allowed that bet to continue to run, even though they understand it's not optimal. And that's what's getting reviewed now, is the math told us we were in this part of the curve. Okay, we were getting paid for it, but now suddenly we're down 11.5%. Let's go back, run it again, and put in place that strategic hedge. And then currencies are an area where there's a lot of room for an active manager to add value. It's a deep liquid market. And so having some tactical overlay around that's attractive, whether it's a currency overlay manager or a fixed income manager that does both currencies and rates, or a hedge fund manager that does a broader basket of things, including commodities. You know, that's attractive for, well, let's have somebody professional look at, and we'll hold them accountable for getting it right around that strategic hedge.
Yeah, I mean, it brings me back in time because, you know, Bridgewater sank its teeth into this issue, recognizing that when you are a foreign investor investing in a market, you're getting, you know, let's say in the equity market or any market as a foreign investor, you're getting the asset return stream, and then you're getting the currency return stream. And the currency return stream has no expected return, but it does have volatility. It may have a return. It's going to have an actual return or loss, but it doesn't have an expected return. And so decoupling that, right, seemed to be a benefit after, as you said, a certain amount of the exposure, because there's trading costs, there's hedging costs in there. But what's interesting is, like, that just didn't, that issue fell off the table over the last 15 years. because you got both of these return streams going up, and now, you know, we are, this is one issue where if you're going to do nothing else, at least, you know, at least take, you know, pay attention to that, because you could get really hurt on currency issues. And that's not really what investors are seeking.
Yep.
Great. Let's go to liquidity, because this whole phenomenon of more, you know, more concentration in equities, less fixed income exposure, you know, less everything else, has also included more illiquid exposure. And today, you know, where endowments used to lead the way, now we find a lot of institutional investors holding a lot of illiquid exposure. I'm wondering how you think about that in the context of very high U.S. equity valuations, very high exposure to those assets, you know, concentrated dollar exposure. It seems like when we look at this, that's a recipe that could create real vulnerability for not at least, you know, keeping your liquidity, your illiquidity, well contained. Is that an overreaction? Do you think it's an underreaction? How are you looking at that? John, let me start with you.
Yeah, I think to start, it's, you know, you don't always control the amount of illiquidity that you have because it's illiquid. And so an example of that is coming out of 2022 when equities and fixed income both went down and you had a lot of denominator effect with folks being over allocated to illiquids. We haven't necessarily seen that correct for a couple of reasons. One, you know, equities rebounded, but fixed income didn't. And as you have outflows, those are still getting paid with equity returns. And then you've had a slowdown in distributions coming from private equity, which has exacerbated the issue a bit. I think at the end of the day, when you're starting in a liquid program, which is very easy to say if you have none today and are not overallocated, of ensuring you are truly thinking about what happens if there's a shock to the portfolio and how does that impact the overall liquidity needs, and making sure you have some pent-up illiquidity, because I think this was well earlier in our conversation, but Rich made the point of when there's an issue in illiquid markets, being a provider of illiquidity of liquidity to that market can be quite beneficial to your portfolio. And so making sure you do have that built up and thinking through that from the standpoint of a overall portfolio that includes illiquids. Where you stand today as a program that might be overweight, it's having to do the tough math of, is it worth selling something at a discount in order to have the opportunity to then be a provider of liquidity, whether that means recommitting to a private equity GP that you wouldn't otherwise be able to, or whether that means going out and being able to be a provider elsewhere in the market, whether that's on the secondary market or other opportunities. And so really thinking about the liquidity holistically, not thinking of it just in, you have this bucket within your portfolio, but thinking about it across and ensuring that you can be that provider of liquidity when it's necessary.
Rich, is that a kind of a threshold piece of advice where if you're sitting with a client, you would say, look, let's take advantage of really good pools of illiquid assets, but let's do it in a size such that if things go wrong, we have the ability to be buyers and take advantage of the dislocation and not be sellers because we're too illiquid.
Short answer is yes. So we've been big advocates, and every time I get the chance on stage, I talk about the benefits of having an opportunistic bucket in your asset allocation and not just having physical cash that you can deploy in a crisis, but having the governance to say, Jim, you don't just have the authority to deploy this, you're accountable. Mm-hmm. If a crisis hits and you don't deploy this money to make our portfolio better off, that's going to be bad for you, because it's really hard in the real world. Usually when there's a crisis, something really bad is going on. And so think about the Friday after the Liberation Day announcements, the market closed down 10 and into its low of the day going into the weekend. And there were no comforting things coming from the administration about changing policy or it's usually something's really bad going on when there's a crisis. And yet, so the governance has to be there, not just the cash. We've seen large sophisticated asset owners find ways to borrow in the physical markets when times are good to afford that physical cash. And they don't leave it in cash because that's not an attractive yield. They equitize it with futures or options to get close to an index fund exposure in equities or bonds or some combination of that. So they're not giving up much economic cost to hold that excess liquidity. But in a crisis, they turn off the derivative overlay. They've got the physical cash. They can deploy it. But you need the cash plus the governance if you're going to do that well.
I just want to talk to you a little bit about tail risk. We talked about inflation. We talked about fiscal sustainability. And there, of course, we've experienced geopolitical shocks. And so you don't really know what's going to create the type of tail risk, but we kind of do know that given the structuring of most institutional portfolios, tail risk would be pretty devastating, like if that occurred. So we did talk about diversification. Of course, that's one way to control tail risk. Are you advising clients at this point of any other additional ways, or is this just an issue you just have to live with and it's not worth to pay for that? Let me start with you, John.
So I think there are times where it's worth to pay, but prices vary of things like options as a more direct tail risk hedge. I think we talked about diversification. Rich mentioned the idea of things like hedge funds, which may be more absolute return focused and may have the ability to perform in down markets. That's where we sit today. We're not at the point where we are advocating for putting on options programs. We typically, we've done that in the past, but it's been at points where we are very concerned of where the economy is and where it may go from there. And so there are other options, but from our perspective, a lot of them are more expensive than they may be worth in the short term. And having the ability to fund premiums over what could be a long period of time before it hits is an important calculus to do ahead of time.
So your answer so far is you would rather do it, let's say, through uncorrelated types of alphas like hedge funds.
That's where we are today. Yeah.
Okay. Rich?
So over the long term, diversification is the cheapest and kind of simplest way to manage against tail risks. But sometimes that's not very satisfactory when the governance bodies see a specific risk on the horizon. And one approach, if they're worried about a specific risk, is to do a costless collar. So they give up some upside above the level that they want to achieve to pay for the downside protection. And that may or may not be the most efficient way to do it, but conceptually, the conversation starts there, and then you can get more efficient in terms of what to do in the options markets. Now, when an asset owner wants to do that, we have to really strongly test for, okay, if this risks resolve itself, because you're not the only one seeing this, right, and the markets pop by 20%, and you've sold everything above 10, are you going to be happy? 10 is your economic objective, or 8 is your economic objective. Ostensibly, you should be happy with 10. But if everybody in your peer group's got 20, are you going to be happy? And yeah, you're protected on the downside. So that's one variant. A different variant is around tail risk creating a liquidity problem. So take a defined benefit pension plan that's 50, 30, 20 with 20 in the liquids. And with the 50 in fixed income, they're hedging 100% of their interest rate and credit risk and their liability. They may be fine if the treasury spikes from, I think it was 4.3 when we started the conversation, to 5.3 or even 6.3. But they will get squeezed out of the hedge because with the illiquids, they won't be able to fund the hedge if it spikes to 7. And that's a really bad scenario. So again, what do you do to make sure you've got the liquidity to maintain the hedge as things move against you, and your liability actually gets cheaper, but the benefit of having the hedge against a subsequent downturn gets more attractive. So some nonlinear approaches to hedging or recognizing that you need a liquidity policy, not just a hedging policy, are part of the overall calculus.
Relative to John, who's basically saying, we're kind of looking to control a lot of this through uncorrelated alphas. That's basically what he's saying, through hedge funds. And you're, if I'm interpreting it correctly, saying we think we can do it more structurally at times with exposures, different types of ways to control exposures as opposed to, let's say, alphas, uncorrelated alphas. Is that right?
Well, we like uncorrelated alphas a lot also. But if your underlying benchmark's 60-40 and the whole thing's down 20%, the uncorrelated alpha of being 4 instead of 2 or 6 instead of 2, it's not actually going to save your bacon.
Right.
So yes, on the uncorrelated alpha, but then structurally, what's the objective in a crisis? How do you want things to perform? Can you take the hit and ride through it because you're really path independent and you only care about the long term? Or do you want to do something to cut off the tails? And the tails need to be cut off with asset allocation, unless you're very atypical. Most organizations, 90% plus of their risk is asset allocation still. The joke is it's more than 100 because the average active manager underperforms. But even if you believe you have skill in picking active managers, and many asset owners don't just believe that, they've demonstrated historically, then still most of your risk is going to be in the asset allocation. It's very hard to get more than, say, 10-15% of your overall risk budget into alpha.
Yeah, I think just to clarify, I think from our perspective, there are opportunities and there are points in time when it may make sense to have more direct or structural hedges on. But as a systematic part of the portfolio, we don't typically hold an options program over the long term.
It's expensive in transactions costs. It's not completely reliable in a crisis, as we saw in the GFC. But also from a governance perspective, clients get tired, asset owners get tired of paying for insurance when the house doesn't burn down. Mm-hmm. So as individuals, we keep paying our insurance premiums, but as institutional investors, paying for downside protection in the derivative markets year in and year out, it tends to get taken off just before the next crisis hits.
So that brings me, I think, to my last question, which is we talked about a lot of different things here. And I know each client is different in terms of not only like their portfolios, but also their governance and how you then advise them. But when you look across the options, like what is the most impactful thing from an investment perspective that you would say needs to be done or should be looked at, let me put it more diplomatically, in order to move the needle today?
What I would start with is it's that taking a step back and making sure you truly understand your objectives and how stakeholders view success. If you don't understand that, then there's no real way to be successful, in particular if you enter into a crisis. And so having that understanding will help you then make the decisions of, can I withstand selling some equities and buying some downside protection or buying some fixed income, as we discussed, or do I need to maintain my return to ensure that I'm thinking through the peer risk that may be out there. And so I think first and foremost, that's the biggest thing that asset owners can do is really make sure they understand what those objectives are and what the objectives of their stakeholders are.
Rich?
I think the most impactful thing that we as consultants or strategists can do with asset owners is pre-mortem, helping them pre-experience what a crisis is really like. And not just the math of here's how the portfolio will return, but how it will feel in the real world. Mm-hmm. So classically, you get the investment committee in a room with staff. There's envelopes. Nobody knows what's in the envelope. They open it, and it's the COVID drawdown again, or it's the GFC, or it's the Japanese bubble. You mentioned some 1970s scenarios earlier, or the Chinese. But it's not happening in China or Japan. It's happening here in the U.S. And so in that environment, what would our portfolio do? But how should our governance behave? And that binds the committee together by pre-experiencing. You know, we're all going through life now and it's pretty good. We've forgotten what it actually felt like in March 2020 when we weren't supposed to go to the grocery store because there's no non-essential travel. And if we did, there was no milk. It wasn't just no toilet paper. Right. I went. I thought I'd get arrested. I needed dog food. I went. I found dog food. But the rest of the grocery store looked like a Brad Pitt zombie apocalypse movie.
Right.
The shelves were empty. And I drove back to my house thinking maybe this time is different. Mm-hmm. You know, we just decided to rebalance. And I was questioning, after studying this stuff my entire life, you know, were we right to rebalance? Now that turned out to be just about the bottom. But trying to recreate, this is what's going to be happening in the real world. And by the way, in your day jobs, you may be worried about rolling your debt. The company may be going under. You know, the university may have just sent the students home. There's going to be other stuff going on, and yet you're expected to rebalance this portfolio or behave opportunistically. Okay, now we've pre-experienced that. We've got all kinds of fear in the room. We've done this anxiety together. What are we going to do about it? Are we going to structurally diversify the underlying portfolio? Are we going to think about being more opportunistic? Are we going to think about having some cash to deploy when others are running for the exit? And are we really going to rebalance or be opportunistic in a crisis? But getting that, because when we do kind of normal asset liability modeling, strategic asset allocation studies, everybody focuses on the middle. You know, they see the math. They kind of think, oh, well, this is math. It's going to work this way. And then they get to a crisis and they're into a tail. And that's when real asset owners outperform and some asset owners run for the exit and tend to get close to the bottom.
Well, that was a thorough and encompassing conversation, and I think hopefully really valuable for our readers and listeners to take in. So, John, I want to thank you so much for your time. Rich, I want to thank you so much for your time. It's been great, and you're invited back. We'll set another date some years hence to talk about this again and see where it all came out.
Thanks so much, Jim, and thanks so much, Rich. This has been great. Thank you for leading a very insightful discussion, and I learned quite a bit sitting next to Rich today, so appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, Jim. John, it's been great doing this with you.